Welcome. I'm Steve Wiggins, and this is podcast number 21 of the Sex and Violence in the Ancient World blog. Today's topic is entitled, Whence Moses? I recently received a request from one of my readers asking where Moses comes from. Where is it that we get this character of Moses? This struck me as an interesting question, not only because of the cultural overlay that Moses receives in our own day and age, but also because of our notions today of how history interacts with religion. One of the features that I constantly tell my students about religion is that religious stories in the ancient world were not always intended to be historical. Quite often, the content of a story maintains its meaning whether or not history is part of the overall picture. In other words, we are concerned about history. We want to know whether or not something actually happened. Ancient writers are a lot less concerned about that. They are more concerned about what the story means. What is its importance? So when it comes to questions about Moses or other figures in the Bible, it's a legitimate question to ask where did they come from if they're not historical. The short answer is we simply don't know where Moses comes from. This character is not attested in other ancient literature besides the Hebrew Bible and sources dependent upon it. So we simply don't know where the Israelites, the Jews, developed the idea of Moses from. The standard argument then in the past has been that if we can't come up with a viable alternative, then by default he must be a historical character. This is problematic in many ways. We can't assume that just because nobody can explain where someone comes from, they had to have been a historical individual. We do know that the records of ancient Egypt give us no indication that there was any kind of foreign interloper who took over command of a bunch of slaves, causing them to escape without any kinds of repercussions from the clutches of Ramses II, who seems to be the pharaoh that would be in reigning pharaoh during the time of Moses' lifetime, if we at all understand the ancient chronology correctly. So why would Moses have developed at all? Why did they need this character? It seems that Moses may be a back projection. And by that I mean that we have to understand that for ancient people, the world that they knew was often constructed around, shall we call them, paradigms that were set up to make sense of their overall history. Moses is part of the foundation myth. And as the Bible itself is laid out, beginning as it does with the Torah, Genesis through Deuteronomy, the story is laid out chronologically. It begins with the creation of the world and then goes through the story of Moses and on into the history of Israel. And in the course of that story, Moses emerges as a foundational character, part of the foundation myth. All nations have foundation myths. We have them in the United States. They have them in every nation in the world. The United States, we have characters like George Washington, Benjamin Franklin, or even Paul Bunyan. All of them are part of our foundation myth, how we think about ourselves. Well, Moses serves that function for the Israelites. He is one of the foundation mythological characters, and he seems to emerge as a back formation to explain why the Torah came to exist. Israel, in its history, had to try and figure out, for their own satisfaction, where God's instructions come from. How do you know what God wants you to do? Well, if you don't have a written Torah, or a book, or a Bible to turn to, you have to rely on human intermediaries. And so, for the most part, people in the biblical world relied on prophets and others who somehow had access to God's direct revelation to give them some kind of indication of what God wanted. What does God require of you? Well, consult a prophet, because they have a way of tapping into the divine psyche, if you will. But the problem with prophets is that they don't always agree with one another. Quite often, prophets actually have disagreements or contradictions between one another. And if you don't have any kind of written record to refer to, no definitive written statement from God himself, then how do you decide between prophets? This was always a perennial problem for Israel. They never really quite knew how you could determine who was a true prophet and who wasn't. After all, there's no way to test prophetic claims. So in a situation like this, you end up having many different prophets who are making claims about what God is telling Israel to do. Over the course of Israel's history, there were a number of prophets, a lot more than meet the eye if you're just simply skimming the table of contents for the Bible. There are many prophetic characters who are mentioned throughout the biblical text who don't have books named after them. So these prophets actually seem to have predated the Torah. Their material was cited and perhaps written down long before there was a written Torah. Now, eventually, there has to come a point where you could draw a line in the sand and say, no more. No more prophets, no more direct revelation, because it gets to be problematic. That line in the sand seems to have been facilitated by the Persians as they started to conquer much of the ancient world. The Persian Empire was founded by Cyrus II, who basically took over the Babylonian Empire somewhere around the year 539. He conquered the city of Babylon itself and became the de facto ruler of the then exiled community of the Jews who had been taken from Jerusalem. And at that time, the Persians tried to reestablish order in the ancient world by allowing people to return home. So the great edict of Cyrus was issued somewhere around the year 538, where he allowed for captive peoples who had been exiled by the Babylonians to return to their homes, figuring that they would be grateful for the opportunity to have their own kind of self-governance, and in doing so, they would remain loyal to the Persians. The people that were allowed to return home were also given the opportunity to establish their own law codes. This gave them a sense of self-governance and a sense of autonomy, which may have been somewhat fictitious, but at least it makes you feel good. You know that you've got the chance to make your own rules and you don't have to live by somebody else's decisions. And so it was that the people of Israel were able, or the people of Judah were able to return to Jerusalem if they wanted to, and have their own laws. At this point, we have a character who's very poorly attested historically, named Ezra, who has his own book in the Hebrew Bible. Ezra returned to the people of Judah sometime after the exile was over. We're not sure exactly when to date him. Many scholars would place him somewhere around the year 400 or so BCE. When Ezra returns to Judah from captivity in Babylon, from the exile, he has with him the five-book Torah, apparently. So for the first time ever, we actually have a written version of Torah. Now, that written version of Torah, of course, supersedes what the prophets have said, because now we have a written record. A written record not only of what we believe, but also a written record of what God himself commands us. That is the way that they understood it. If you look at the prophets and see how many times that the prophet says you should do this because the Torah says so, you'll come up with a very small number indeed. The prophets are self-referential. They refer to God and their own outlook and not that of an amorphous written Torah, because the Torah does not yet exist. But Ezra is not exactly what we call the most charismatic of figures in the Bible. He is a relatively unknown character. His role is that of a priest, and he is, of course, known as a lawgiver. Well, traditions about Moses probably pre-existed Ezra. In other words, even if he did not exist as a historical person, and we simply don't know, there's no way to test whether there was a Moses or not. So if Moses did exist, or even if he didn't, people had this idea of who he was. He was the great liberator who led people out of Egypt, across the desert, into the Holy Land. The same idea applies to Ezra. Ezra may not be leading a bunch of people from Egypt to freedom in Israel, but he is leading people from captivity in Babylon across the desert back to Judah, where they are free to establish their own law. So in a sense, Ezra becomes the Moses with feet for the people of the post-exilic period. Now, if you're going to make a Torah compete with several prophets who have their own interests in having their point of view of what Yahweh wants to stand a chance, how is this Torah going to stand a chance against all these prophets? You have to allow for the veracity of the lawgiver. Now, what are we going to say about Ezra? Say, if we are living in the 4th century or maybe the 3rd century, and we see that we've got this character here, and he's right there in front of us. We have this character of Ezra, and he's just one of us. Well, his message becomes a lot more potent, a lot more urgent, if we can relate that message back to our founding mythical ancestor, Moses. We say, it was not Ezra who brought us the Torah, but it was Moses. And so when Ezra brings the Torah, what he's doing is reestablishing something that had come about before through Moses himself. Well, that's one way of understanding it. The fact is, we simply don't know where Moses comes from. And if we look at the historical records, we find that some of the incidents in Moses' life were actually told about other people before Moses. Even the story of his birth, of being placed in a basket of reeds and set afloat on the Nile River, was pre-anticipated, or anticipated maybe is the word I'm looking for here, by the story of Sargon, the king of Akkad. Sargon reigned somewhere around the year 2300 BCE, roughly 1,000 years before Moses. And in his story of royal legitimation, he tells us that he was also set in a basket made of reeds and set to float on the river, presumably the Euphrates, until he was found and raised in the royal palace and became king. So stories like this, which fit into the overall picture of who Moses should be, were incorporated into the character of a person who everybody knew about because he is an ancestor, a founding ancestor, a foundational character, but about which very little historical or accurate information was actually known. Now, this doesn't devalue who Moses was. All it means is that we really know very little about him. He becomes larger with the telling. His career becomes greater. His role in Israel's history becomes greater. And because of the way that we in the Western world read books, starting at the beginning and assuming that the early material was written earlier than the end material, we see that the Bible presents Moses as giving the Torah at the very beginning, and Israel had it as part of their tradition from the very start. Historically, that doesn't seem to be the case. Historically, the Torah seems to come much later, and Moses is made the facilitator of Torah because he is the one who traditionally brought us the law. The biblical message is one that fits the worldview of the Bible, and we as modern-day people, looking back at that worldview, have lost track of what it actually is because we live in a completely different way, a completely different worldview ourselves, and we view how books are composed and how traditions develop differently than biblical people did. So as we start to think about where Moses comes from, this podcast does not answer the question. It simply acknowledges that it is an issue. We should realize that ancient people and modern people are alike in very significant ways, and most obviously in the way of understanding that when we don't know the facts about a great hero's beginning, we, the ancient Israelites, like us, felt free to make something up that fit what they thought was the character of this person, and that's what, after all, makes a good story.